Okay. Once again, technology fails us abysmally. What I'm going to do, I think, is I have a slideshow on Bishop and the poetry of the 1950s. What I'll do is try and upload it to the LMW website so you can at least look at what I'm supposed to be referring to when I go through the lecture. But apologies. This system, I would encourage you all to complain about this computer because it seems rigged against anybody who's outside of the Warwick Manufacturing Group. Okay, Elizabeth Bishop in the 1950s. I have three goals in this lecture. The first is to introduce poetry from the mid-20th century to see how it differs from that of earlier modernists that you've read, like Eliot and Williams in the last term. And by so doing, I want to open up the question of how we might read poetry in this altered context. We are now not in the 19-teens and 1920s. We're in the 1950s and 60s. So a reasonable supposition might be that poetry is not only engaging different subject matters at this point in the century, in this juncture of literature in the modern world, but it's also itself undergoing changes as a medium. Yeah? How does poetry respond to the presence of, for example, newer media like television, new forms of global connection, new ways of making sense? That is, if we suppose that poetry doesn't just continue as a traditional mode of literary expression and communication, what can we discover in the work of a poet like Elizabeth Bishop that speaks to this? I also want to lay the basis for perhaps future study in American poetry, not only of the 20th century, but even of the 21st, because as you go through your honors years here at Warwick, you're likely to encounter that. Now, there's an initial question that must come to everybody's mind when they're thinking about why Bishop, why this poet in the 1950s, on this module, and that is, we have tended not to emphasize literature as exclusively the product of a distinctly national experience or national history or national identity. Instead, we approach it comparatively as part of a world phenomenon of writing. So one question is, why study American poetry of this period particularly? Well, you could say that one reason is that in the mid-20th century, the United States is a dominant presence on the world stage. And how we read its cultural production then is increasingly the way that we read, for example, writing out of China and India today as a world map or a guide to the salient features of the global conjuncture. There are two models for studying literature that the theorist Franco Moretti likes to talk about when he's engaging the question of why comparative approaches, why comparativism in literary study. And he says that you can imagine the study of literature according to the model of a tree or the model of a wave. I might have even mentioned this earlier. The tree is the model of a distinctively national development. That is, a central trunk throwing off branches on one side or the other. So, for example, you know, the trunk of English literature, which throws off the branches of a Dickens or a George Eliot or a Jane Austen and so forth. But referring back to some kind of central identity that is associated with that national tradition. The wave, by contrast, is a model of transnational flows, whereby forms cross linguistic and national boundaries in a continually fluid and a continually transformative process of travel and of discovery, but also of colonization and of disruption. I think just a cursory acquaintance with the Bishop shows you at least one reason why I would prefer to read her under the heading of the wave than of the tree. That is, many of Bishop's poems refer not to an indigenous subject matter, a native subject matter having to do with the United States as a territory, but instead with the experience of travel. And more broadly, the experience of dispersal, geographically speaking. So, although there are many ways that we could read this poet, and there are many questions that we could entertain about why this poet, the question that I want to focus on particularly is reading Bishop and some other poets from the mid-20th century as an entry into the problem of how to read global consciousness in writing. How does it manifest itself? What does it mean when we speak of global consciousness as opposed to other forms? And global consciousness is not just a problem of poetry. Since we're dealing with not just what can be said in a straightforward way about being in the modern world, but with what poetry is especially good at, which is naming particulars that resist translation. I'm going to say a little bit more about that in relation to previous ways of analyzing lyric poetry in particular. But naming particulars that resist translation is, you know, poetry famously is that which is lost in translation, is therefore something that should give us pause when we're considering it within the framework of a global mode of reading, a global mode of understanding writing significance. That is, if poetry is what resists translation and global consciousness depends in some way on forms of translation, how might poetry register the world's details, not just the poet's details within her sphere of personal acquaintance, but the world's details, except as a kind of form of parochialism or of tourism or of the kind of neo-imperial flattening out that we get with globalized culture? Think about the McDonaldization of the world. That's one form of the wave, of course. The way that Hollywood and Coca-Cola and McDonald's covers every surface of the world, seeking out to new markets to exploit, to infiltrate. That is one image of the American presence in the mid-century. Bishop has a highly precarious and conflicted relationship to what was then America's dominant position as a global power. We want to see in what ways that might be the case. Just as a sort of heuristic entry into this way of thinking about poetry, we might want to dwell on something that the theorist Theodore Adorno says in his magisterial book, Aesthetic Theory. One of the more dense and impenetrable works of literary theory written in the last century, but full of suggestive insights, like little nuggets of gold amidst the rock. And one of his aphorisms is that the unsolved contradictions of reality return in artworks as imminent problems of form. What does Adorno mean by this? Well, he's trying to get us away from simply seeing a straightforward one-to-one transposition of the problems or contradictions or tensions in reality as expressions in the subject matter of poems. It can happen that way, but, suggests Adorno, that is not where poetry is most engaging and provocative. What happens in poetry is that those unsolved contradictions of reality, for example, the presence of a dominant world power as a colonizing agency in other parts of the world, how that enters into poetry as a question specifically of poetic form, of the choices, witting and unwitting, that a poet makes in how to write, what to notice, what to leave out, what strictures to adopt, what freedoms to announce and embrace in their work. So watch for the way in which there may be a discomposition in the composition of Bishop's work, a kind of troubling of its surface. When Bishop, she's probably the most consecrated mainstream American poet of the last 60 or so years, 60 or 70 years now. And it's often as if what Bishop supplies for an American poetic mainstream is an easy way to say, well, this is what still what we are good at. You know, we're good at this kind of wonderful killer description. We're good at writing poems that are very focused and attentive on the particulars of the everyday in a kind of colloquial voice that's not overbearing or overweeningly rhetorical, that doesn't hector us, tell us what to believe, what to look at, that is full of the kind of thoughtful, pensive attention to the daily and the insignificant that makes poetry worthwhile. New Yorker magazine poetry, in other words, or you might call it even Times Literary Supplement poetry until quite recently. That kind of poetry, that kind of image of what poetry does is what Bishop's poetry has fit into very well, very nicely. And she's often been held up as a kind of icon of tranquility, calm, patience in her writing. What I want to suggest to you is that is a misinformed image of her work. That instead, what drives most of what's compelling about her work is not its tranquility, its peacefulness, its American peacefulness and patience, but rather a kind of fear, or even you might call it a kind of panic. And there is a collection of essays devoted to Bishop called Bishop and the Modes of Panic, which I think is quite apropos here. There is a kind of profound unease in some of these poems that we need to tease out if we're to come to terms with what's distinctive about what Bishop is doing. So I suggest that if we're going to try and come to terms with some of these questions in Bishop, the question of global consciousness and the question of America's place in the world circa 1950, 1960, that we begin naively, as it were, because many of Bishop's own poems begin with a kind of naivete, as if we're, just uninformed and not particularly widely read readers encountering poetry for the first time. Take, for example, her poem that begins her first collection, North and South, which came out in 1946, called The Map. I'm hoping most of you have collections with you. This poem seems to be quite straightforward on first reading, quite simple in its procedures. Land lies in water. It is shadowed green. Shadows, or are they shallows at its edges, showing the line of long seaweeded ledges where weeds hang to the simple blue from green? Or does the land lean down to lift the sea from under, drawing it unperturbed around itself? Along the fine tan sandy shelf, is the land tugging at the sea from under? We have here a scenario whereby the poet seems to be focusing our attention on the surface particulars, the material qualities of a map itself. Isn't it interesting the way cartographers use conventions to indicate, for example, a division between land and sea, the way in which the varied instances of topography are suggested through graphical means and so forth. But by the time we get to the end of the poem, something slightly different seems to have been insinuated into the field of its concerns. This is the last stanza. Mapped waters are more quiet than the land is, lending the land their waves' own conformation. And Norway's hair runs south in agitation. Profiles investigate the sea where land is. Are they assigned, or can the countries pick their colors? What suits the character or the native waters best? Topography displays no favorites, norths as near as west. More delicate than the historians are the map makers' colors. Well, perhaps one indication of what is not apparent on the surface may be suggested by the place names that this poem uses. For example, when we have mention of Norway, of Newfoundland, of Labrador, where are we in the world? Say? Northern Hemisphere, exactly so. And the title of the collection is North and South, so evidently we start off in the north. Why do we start in the north? Is it necessary to start on the up side of the world's representation as a map? Perhaps not. One of Bishop's contemporaries, the Chilean poet Vicente Huidobro, has a wonderful three-line poem. It's almost like a haiku, and it goes like this. The four cardinal points are three, south and north. I'll say that again. The four cardinal points are three, south and north. It's almost like a little Zen koan for you to puzzle over. But if we think about the map and the points of the compass as a kind of standardized convention, and then we think about north and south as a kind of conventionalized representation on a map, why do we necessarily begin with the north? If you're living in Chile, for example, that's your north, really. It's your side of the globe. You're pointing towards the Antarctic instead of the Arctic, but what's down is up from another perspective. Now, what I like about that poem is partly it is a kind of stand-up joke, in effect, the way in which we're teased away from our preconceptions about geography. But what I also like about it in relation to the bishop is that it disorients or skews or displaces our native assumptions about the way things should be represented geographically and, by implication, politically and geographically through maps and map making. This is something that Bishop points to in that line. Are they assigned or can the countries pick their colors? Well, that's a loaded question, isn't it? Who gets to assign colors to countries? And especially circa 1950, if you were dividing the world up into areas of influence, you might come up with a great mass of one kind of color and a great mass of another kind of color, and perhaps less so in between. That is, territories are, by definition, politically inflected in their designation. And this is something that Bishop both indicates but never states directly, even in this apparently naive-seeming poem. There's another indication of her area of concerns with geography in the epigraph to her last book, which is significantly titled Geography 3, as if her earlier two collections, North and South and Questions of Travel, are Geography 1 and 2. This is on page 158 of the complete poems that you might have. But it is the epigraph to that last book, to Geography 3 from 1976. Here's how it goes. What is a map? A picture of the whole or a part of the Earth's surface. What are the directions on a map? Toward the top, north. Toward the bottom, south. To the right, east. To the left, west. In what direction from the center of the picture is the island? North. In what direction is the volcano, the cape, the bay, the lake, the strait, the mountains, the isthmus? What is in the east, in the west, in the south, in the north, in the northwest, in the southeast, in the northeast, in the southwest? So it begins as the straightforward questions from a primer, a kind of Q&A that's part of a lesson, Montes Geographical Series, First Lessons in Geography, becomes a curious kind of dizzying vertigo with respect to questions of direction and of location. The facts, in other words, where is the north, where is the south, where is the island, where is the cape, lead to a kind of panic, a kind of stress-induced overload of information and questioning that seem significant to the poet as an indication of the difficulties in self-location as well. Now, one of Bishop's obvious themes that you can see even just from a casual reading of the poems is the question of identity itself. And identity not just as a matter of personal or human location, but also that of the wider biosphere, the world of animals, for example. She's very attentive to animal life and descriptions of animals and birds and so forth. Just again, as you might expect a mainstream poet to be. But again, those questions are underpinned for Bishop by this question of displacement and unease, even panic, that comes from dramatic and sometimes violent change. A good instance of this is probably my own personal favorite among Bishop's poems, which is called In the Waiting Room. That's the very next page from that epigraph. The scenario is a 7 or a 6-year-old bishop waiting in a dentist's office while her aunt has some dental work done, her aunt Consuelo. And it's winter 1918. And she's looking at the magazine National Geographic. Now, National Geographic is a terrific instance of a neo-colonial American form of representation of the world in the 20th century. It came out monthly. It was filled with a color photography of a quite advanced nature from early in its run, and it was well known for depicting the native tribes of far-flung, exotically foreign and underdeveloped areas of the world in the way that an anthropologist might present evidence of field work. And in so doing, it provided a kind of an exoticized introduction to the variousness of the world's cultures for American readers. And it often did so through the implicit understanding that these cultures were in some way under threat by modernity and liable to vanish. In the same way that, of course, the Native American tribes in North America had vanished under the pressures of genocide over the past 2 centuries. So there's Bishop reading her National Geographic in that waiting room in the dentist's office, and she comes to a kind of moment of identity crisis, a moment of vertigo that's perhaps similar in its panicky rush to that that run of questions in the epigraph to the book. I said to myself, this is on the second page of the poem, I said to myself, 3 days and you'll be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one, too? I think that pun is intentional. Why should you be one, too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was. I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher at shadowy gray knees, trousers and skirts and boots and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. Kind of surreal image, disconnected body parts. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt, or me, or anyone? What similarities? Boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breasts, the breasts of the tribeswomen that she's been looking at, held us all together, or made us all just one. How, I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely. Now, this is a moment of crisis, identity crisis, in the sense of the dizzying arbitrariness of being oneself rather than another in a particular point in time and space. That's why the poem is so insistent on February 1918, and ends this way. The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another. Then I was back in it. The war was on, outside in Worcester, Massachusetts, where night and slush and cold, and it was still the 5th of February, 1918. What's naive about the poem, of course, is the perspective of the child, who questions why she should be there in the first place, why she should be assigned this particular identity, this particular color, and not another. Why she should be reading this magazine about these tribesmen in the Amazon, and why she should be associated with her aunt, who's having the dental work, and so forth. That kind of moment of profound destabilization is something that you can see consistently throughout Bishop's work. And when it's not there, I think that's when you ought to be suspicious. The poem In the Filling Station, which is in that same book, is a good example of what I mean here. There, it seems like everything is set up for the to assure us of the rightness of the world. But for Bishop, you can never be sure, really, of the rightness of the world. And you can never be sure of your location within it. And that's the signal moment, the hallmark, really, of that moment of unease, of panic, of identity displacement, which we can read as a generalized instance of what's troubling an American poet in the 1950s and 60s. What might that be? Well, part of the United States mandate, if you like, in the 1950s was a form of containment. Containment both domestically after the war as a way of repressing the energies that were unleashed, you know, socially speaking, in the U.S., and also internationally through the adoption of a kind of Cold War policy of restriction and of regime management. In fact, the fruits of the Arab Spring that we're now witnessing in the past month or so are in some ways traceable back to this particular moment when the United States set up a series of client states around the world, often involving dictatorships as a way of managing its Cold War strategy. Now, containment is an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? It's about repression, suppression, dissidents, native, domestically speaking, dissidents, both cultural but sexual as well. Homosexuals were actively persecuted during this time. On the slideshow, when you see it, I have a quotation from the Congressional Record that is directed at flushing out homosexuals from government as being as dangerous in a way on a par with communists. And certainly anybody of a distant political persuasion was under suspicion at this time as well. But then containment overseas is symbiotic with that containment at home. The repression of dissident energies among the world's peoples was also part of a containment mandate alongside the domestic one. Where does Bishop, and by extension poetry, find itself in that kind of scenario? Well, Bishop herself was homosexual. She never mentions it in her poetry. The details of her personal and particular background are not the substance of her work in the way that they were, for example, of her contemporaries like Robert Lowell, famously a confessional poet. Or one could point to Frank O'Hara, the New York poet, who rather wonderfully assumes that his particular sexual orientation is the way everybody should be and seems to disregard the McCarthyite repression of the 1950s. Quite successfully. Or even more flamboyantly, Allen Ginsberg, who perhaps you will be hearing about next week, who became an icon of the 1960s for his courageousness in standing up to the policing of sexual and cultural and political boundaries during this period. But Bishop isn't like that. She doesn't mention any of that stuff. And even though she was appointed poet of the Library of Congress in 1950, It was never any part of her mandate to either resist or speak up for repressed or subordinated minority communities. But what I want to suggest is in your seminars, you take a good look at those moments in the poems that seem to figure that kind of repression, that kind of containment at a local or even a micro level. And this often happens with the way that she handles the figure of animals, for example. One of the poems that she's best known for is a poem dedicated to her friend Robert Lowell, The Armadillo. It seems to be just a poem, again, on the face of it, about a particular holiday practice in Brazil, where she had moved in the 1950s and stayed for a good 15 years with in the house of her lover, Lota de Soares, de Maceo Soares, who was a very well-known architect in Rio. Bishop is simply describing a kind of holiday celebration around Easter where fire balloons are sent up from the mountains around Rio, and where sometimes they have unintended consequences. That is, when they crash, they set wildfires. And the poem simply seems to document the way that the animals of the hillsides around Rio are victimized by this practice. When the fire balloon crashes and sets off a kind of brush fire, animals lose their homes, nests, so forth. They escape. They have to escape the coming Holocaust by any means necessary, including the armadillo, the titular figure of the poem. Looked at in another way, though, and especially in light of its final lines, you can see allegorical resonances to the figures of those animals fleeing the fire. So what I want you to do is put your internationally focused antennae on, and wherever you can, find moments in the bishop poems where there seems to be something else going on than what is simply there on the surface, what is simply being presented straightforwardly enough as the subject matter of the poem. Remember Adorno again. It's the contradictions of reality that return as imminent problems of form. What can I say? How can I say it? What is allowable, permissible for me to say within the constraints of what is given me? And this is something that Bishop confronts time and time again. Containment policy in the 1950s is also associated with what notoriously became the domino theory. The domino theory was the notion that if one country became communist, then rapidly others neighboring around would become communist as well. That is, like dominoes arranged in a row, they would all topple. And one of the fruits of this particular mode of foreign policy thinking was, of course, the quagmire that became Vietnam. In 1954, the French were defeated at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and the United States effectively stepped in where the old colonial power France had failed. They stepped in and attempted to prop up an ailing southern Vietnam regime. What's distinctive about 1954 and about the United States' entry into the conflict then, which was only to escalate in the 1960s, was the use of a particularly deadly and gruesome weapon, which was napalm, the kind of liquid fire that sticks to the skins of its victims and burns to the bone, cannot be got rid of. Read the last few stanzas, then, of The Armadillo with that image in mind, perhaps the famous image of the Vietnamese girl running down the road with the burns from napalm on her body. Her clothes have been burnt off from 1970, which has in many ways become a kind of iconic summing up of the bestiality of that war. Read then Bishop's description of the effects, the consequences of the wildfire with that in mind, because it is surely part of the context, if not the immediate foreground of her writing of the poem. Okay, I'll just sort of cycle back a little bit and just mention something about the 1950s that is also, I think, germane to our reading of this poet and our understanding of what is possible in terms of global consciousness during this period. In 1938, there was published probably the most successful poetry textbook ever. It was called Understanding Poetry. It was edited by Cleanth Brooks and Robert Penn Warren. Warren himself was a poet. Brooks was the most famous of the so-called New Critics, who insisted, in some ways similar to Empson and Richards, I.A. Richards in this country, who insisted that what mattered about poetry was nothing external to the poem itself, but simply its management of the problems of form. That is, they insisted on poetry's autonomy. Now, this was not simply a ruse. The attention to form, the attention to technique, the attention to qualities of irony, of paradox, of illusion, of metaphor, and metonymy, and so forth, all of this was certainly absolutely valid as a way of approaching poetry. But it was only valid insofar as we understood what underpinned that autonomy in the first place. And that's something that Brooks and Warren didn't really address. They suggested instead that we read poems as poems and only as poems without reference to the biographical, to the historical, certainly to the political, and even the psychological and sexual and so forth. Those, for the editors of this textbook, were a fundamentally extraneous to what poetry was all about. Now think back to the definition of poetry as that which resists translation. In a sense, resisting translation is what New Criticism was all about, focusing on the specificity of each poem, its particular and unique handling of problems of form. But at the same time, what makes form? What makes form possible and available? This is a set of questions that Brooks and Warren didn't concern themselves with so much. I want to suggest that poetry's autonomy and the kind of new critical modes of reading that go along with it are only possible insofar as you take into account all of those external determinations that they wanted to exclude from consideration. It's only then, when you pay attention to the pressures, the panic-inducing pressure of outside forces, that you can understand just what makes poetry compelling when it is compelling. And this is something that I think Bishop intuits. Whether she ever came out and said so is less important, because her poems manifest, again, as a formal problem, precisely all the kinds of pressures and anxiety and determination that comes from the kind of containment policies, for example, for which the United States was known in the 1950s. So along with understanding the poems as formal devices, as machines made of words, as William Carlos Williams called poetry famously earlier in the century, we need to see how that machine made of words was itself functioning within a larger network of considerations. And one of those things has to be, surely, the way in which poetry documents displacement, documents travel, documents flow, including transnational flow. That's why the book I think that you really need to focus on within the Bishop Collected is Questions of Travel, her document of her time in Brazil, and the way in which her touristic understanding of Brazil as an exotic foreign place is gradually eroded and replaced by an ironical understanding of her own fundamentally estranged position. You know, she was squatting herself, Bishop was, when she was living in Brazil. So when you read a poem like Squatter's Children, you need to see the reflexivity that's at work between what Bishop is writing about vis-a-vis the poor children of the favelas outside Rio and her own position. It's a highly asymmetrical relationship. Bishop is a privileged North American woman who is able to live in comfort in Rio, and the squatter's children are the poorest of the poor. And yet, she's able to see some of the ironies involved in that kind of asymmetrical relation between their two situations. Throughout Questions of Travel, you have this kind of insistent teasing, almost, allusion to the fact of being a tourist, to the fact of being an outsider. But the truth is, Bishop felt like an outsider throughout her life, not just as a homosexual, not just as a poet who never married and never had a proper home, who was always moving about, often to peripheral places, places like Key West, Florida, or to Cape Breton in Canada. She never felt particularly comfortable in any kind of central location, for example, Washington, D.C., when she was appointed poet of the Library of Congress, the kind of poet laureateship that now exists. Instead, she liked to flee. She liked to flee to the margins. Now, that kind of marginal travel is interesting in and of itself, but I think it has a specific kind of effect on the subject matter in her work. Why did she choose to write about this and not that, you might ask? Why did she choose to write about coming into the port of Santos when it was so mundane and ordinary an experience, rather than something more, you know, something more interestingly picturesque? What happens to the status of the picturesque itself in her poems? These are all questions that you need to entertain. Finally, I would like you, when you hopefully do get a chance to look at the slides, to check out the last poem that I've included in them, which is not Bishop's, but is instead a poem by Frank O'Hara called The Day Lady Died. The reason I think that's important to do is because you don't get a sense of what's distinctive about Bishop unless you compare with other poets working at the same time. And O'Hara, as a cosmopolitan poet living in New York, at the center of the art world of the time when it was at its most dominant, gives us a very different inflection on the question of global consciousness from Bishop. At the same time, there are interesting shared parallels. The poem, The Day Lady Died, refers to the death of Billie Holiday, the great jazz singer, who the poet learns, which the poet learns about by seeing on the cover of a newspaper. But the rest of the poem is really not about Billie Holiday at all. It's about his everyday lunch routine of looking around for gifts to give to some friends of his that he's going to be seeing on the weekend. And, you know, just the sort of the minutiae of a kind of cosmopolitan urban gay man's day in Midtown Manhattan and all of the detail and density that affords. But in those details, I think you can see some of the same impingement of global concerns that you see elsewhere in Bishop's poems as well. For example, the insistent mention of writers from outside the United States, the way in which writers from outside the United States have now surged into the surface of American consciousness as a source of energy, as a source of excitement. The way in which Africa is presented is very interesting in that poem, especially when you consider the links between Africa and Billie Holiday as an African-American singer. And the whole way in which the culture of the repressed, of the contained, of the persecuted — Billie Holiday herself was persecuted by the police in New York, denied a license to sing because of her heroin addiction — how that becomes itself a kind of series of parallels or analogous situations with the poet's own situation as a gay man who loves art and who's living the fabulous flaneur consumer life in Manhattan. Read The Day Lady Died in juxtaposition, that is, to poems like The Armadillo, to poems like In the Waiting Room, and others of Bishop's oeuvre. And then you can begin to get a sense of what was distinctive about the 1950s, why this was such an interesting time for poetry and for art generally. Okay, thanks.